Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, who's on assignment in India. And you're listening to The World. Today, Denmark became the latest flashpoint in Europe's ongoing migrant crisis. Danish authorities shut down train service from Germany after intercepting hundreds of migrants on their way to Sweden. Gives you an idea of how the crisis has spread through the continent. Already this year, more than 500,000 people have sought asylum in Europe. It's being called the biggest refugee crisis since World War II. Joel Millman has been monitoring this. He's with the International Organization for Migration in Geneva. Joel, why are so many people on the move right now?
Well, you know, they're on the move worldwide. Our director general often talks about this is the most mobile time in world history. One of every seven people, or about a billion people on the planet, are considered migrants. And the movement towards Europe, we think, would be happening in any case because of the demographic polar opposites that are attracting each other. Europe has a falling birth rate, is really in great demand for cheap imported labor right now, has been for decades, is in need of this labor, but it's especially acute now. And the countries around the Mediterranean, the Middle East, North Africa, even as far away as Afghanistan, are creating a very youthful and well-trained workforce for which there's really no jobs. So we would be seeing this migration in a sort of a slower, gradual fashion under any conditions.
Yeah, but why this summer? Why not last summer?
Well, I think the real driver of all this is the Syrian crisis, which is now entering its fifth year. And obviously, many of the people, and there's approximately 4 million in the surrounding countries that have fled Syria, many of them would have wanted to go home and probably expected to go home in the first few months of their evacuation, possibly into the first couple of years. But now, after so many years, reality has set in. There does not seem to be a negotiated settlement in sight. In fact, we're not even aware of any talks going on to bring this crisis to a close. So this has stimulated a kind of an open the floodgates kind of moment. And also, you know, all this cross-Mediterranean traffic over the last 2 years originating in Libya has had a profound effect on people all over the world through social media. It's sending a message home to villages all over the hemisphere that, you know, the boat route to Europe is dangerous, it's risky, but, you know, 99% are getting through and they're finding a way to stay in Europe. So that's very attractive to people.
Well, you made reference to it, but I'll ask it. You mentioned that a lot of the Syrian refugees and migrants are people who may be already out of the country. Are most of the Syrian refugees and migrants that we're seeing trying to get to Germany or some other EU country, are they people who are coming from a second country, or are they coming directly from Syria?
We interview people almost every day when they come off the boats in the different places, and we hear both. You know, we hear people that left Kobani a week or two ago, and we have people that left 2 years ago from that spot, the same place, in a refugee camp in Turkey. I'm not really sure that it affects the legitimacy of considering someone a refugee or not. The time for resettlement now in a refugee camp worldwide has stretched to 17 years. That's the average. So you're asking people that have no real prospect of going home. They probably went to that camp thinking, maybe in a month or two, I'll be back cleaning the rubble out of my house. But they don't think that way anymore. And they're just not going to stay, you know, and see their kids have kids, you know, in the same refugee camp.
We're talking about Syrian refugees and migrants, but I wonder from your work, is there still a large group of people coming from sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, the largest group coming to Italy this year, and it's up around 35,000, which is approaching last year's total, is from Eritrea. This is sub-Saharan. It's the Horn of Africa. It's considered a terribly oppressive state. There's a kind of open-ended, indefinite military draft, so a lot of the people who are leaving are college age, who are afraid to be contracted into the army and never get out. They are the number one. And right behind them would be Nigeria for Africa. And that's obviously a large country, and there's been a lot of violence with Boko Haram.
Joel, you were also a journalist for many years before your current work. If you were writing a follow-up story about what's on the horizon, what would your headline be?
I don't know what my headline would be. I was not a great headline writer, but I would say that Europe has finally woken up to this. And partly it's the image of that little boy who drowned last week. Partly it's the images of the 71 people who suffocated in a truck the week before that. And I think they are realizing, the whole world is realizing, that these are problems that the root of which is the unstable regimes that people are fleeing from. If you do not engage, you'll pay the price later, because the people who are hurt by these conflicts don't intend to be ignored. And they will reach safety, and they will reach your doorsteps, and they will demand their benefits, their rights as human beings. And so I think Europeans have woken up to this, and so has the rest of the world, that this is an international emergency that has to be dealt with comprehensively.
Joel Millman is with the International Organization for Migration in Geneva. Thanks, Joel.
Thanks, Carol.
Belgrade is one of the main hubs in the migrant exodus, and among the thousands stranded there is 22-year-old Farouk Mohammed from Pakistan. He spent the last 3 months trying to get to Germany. He started in Iran, then traveled to Turkey, Greece, Macedonia, and now Serbia. Mohammed says he doesn't want to go to Hungary because he'd be fingerprinted there. That could force him to seek residency in Hungary instead of in a more affluent and welcoming European country. Earlier, Mohammed spoke to us via Skype on his cell phone near the Belgrade bus station. I asked him how he's been getting around.
With the train, with the bus, by foot, and with taxi sometimes. In the Greece, when I cross the border, we are a 500 person when we cross a border.
And now, how long have you been in Serbia?
1 month I stay here in Serbia because I'm afraid about the Hungarian police. I was in Hungary in jail because I didn't want to give my fingerprint. If I give my fingerprints, then I go to Germany and Germany send me back in Hungary.
So you're saying you already went as far as Hungary, but then found yourself in jail and came back to Serbia? Is that it?
Yeah.
So what's your next move?
Now, I decide I go to Croatia, Bosnia, and Slovenia, and Austria, and after that, Germany. That's the long way, and that is a very difficult way to travel.
How are you figuring things out? Are you using a smartphone?
I have on my phone, so I'm looking for Google Maps. From there, I see how can I go from this city, and after that, from there, from here, like this. I'm using smartphone.
Did you leave family behind in Pakistan?
I have a 3 sisters, and we are 2 brothers. And my father is a guy, and I have my mom.
So you left them all back in Pakistan. Why did you leave Pakistan?
Because you know about the Pakistan, we have a problem in economics because in Pakistan, we're making nuclear bombs, we don't making electricity.
So you're saying that a country that's able to make a nuclear bomb but not provide consistent electricity, you're trying to get to a country that has a better infrastructure and better work opportunities?
Of course, when you have electricity in Pakistan, you see in the 24 hours, just 10 hours, we have electricity and 14 hours, nothing.
Are you in touch with your family at all?
Yeah, I've been speaking with my mom. I'm speaking with my family.
Are they worried about you?
Of course, you know about the mom is a mom also. And your sister and my brothers, everyone is sad. What are you doing? Come back.
Farouk, you mentioned that the journey can be dangerous. You're worried about certain parts of the route between where you are in Serbia and getting to Germany. What are the dangers?
In Hungary, the police is so rude.
You're worried about the police in Hungary because they haven't exactly been welcome to migrants.
He doesn't respecting human being, that's Hungarian police. If I ask something, sir, I need water, I need something, food, he don't speak with me English. And when he needs something, he's speaking English with me. I said, sir, you are not speaking English. And now how can you learn just in the 20 minutes to speak English?
Farouk, if you knew how difficult the journey would be, do you think you would have done it?
I think not, but my reason is I want to make my future, you know, because I'm a 22 years old, so I have to do something. I want to work and send money in my home because I want my sister to get married, and after that, I will be happy.
Farouk, thanks so much for speaking to us.
You're welcome.
That was Farouk Mohammed, a 22-year-old Pakistani migrant. He joined us from a center run by the relief group ADRA near Belgrade's bus station. As Farouk's story makes clear, not all of those seeking entry into Europe are refugees from Syria. Iraqi journalist Sahar Issa lives in Baghdad. She says many displaced Iraqis are among the stream of migrants heading north.
They are living in camps. In Iraq, in camps in the summer, this kind of summer, living in these dire conditions. And so what do? They have lost their schools. They've lost their livelihoods. Of course, they immigrate. And that's what they've been doing.
I understand you have some relatives who have also made this journey. Tell us about them.
It came as a surprise to me when I was talking to my cousin, who is an immigrant herself. And she is now in Turkey with the immigrant status. And she told me that their son-in-law was lost at sea. And there was a group who were going, I think, to Serbia or something like that. And when they reached their destination, he simply wasn't there. He was lost during their passage on the sea. And they're looking for him. And my cousin, she isn't like from the moon. She's like one of the people who have gone there. All of them have relatives who are taking the passage to Europe. The thing that I would like to spotlight is recently we used to before see only young men making this passage, but now we see whole families. They are in dire conditions and they are making the passage because they don't see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Why now? The difficulties in Iraq, the war in Iraq, the violence there has been going on for a number of years. What is spurring this exodus now?
The exodus, of course, is spurred as all Iraqi revolutions, if you go back in history, by the summer. The conditions in Iraq during the summer are very difficult. If there is no water and there is no electricity, either you provide water and some kind of relief for your family, or your family is going to die. It used to be an exodus of young people, of young men who are looking for their fortune, as you would have me say it. But now it is like you see whole families leaving with babies and children. And, you know, they're just going. They are leaving everything behind because this summer was very hot and there was no provision by the government. There was a lack of water. There was a lack of electricity, and so they've lost hope.
Why do you stay?
I will tell you. I am staying simply because I can still, to this very day, afford to buy electricity. This is one thing. And the other thing is, if you have a relative that is in the ICU, that is the intensive care unit, and that person is going to die, I don't know how to describe it to you. I still have hope that maybe someone is going to come to the forefront with whom at least some of us can work to bring it around, to make it right. Because like if everyone leaves, like who's going to be here to make it right?
Is this flow of migrants out of Iraq, is it an embarrassment to the Iraqi government?
It is a big embarrassment to the Iraqi government. But you know what? They have lost all sense of shame. Only yesterday, Al-Ja'fari, this is one of the prominent politicians, and he is leader of the Shi'at coalition in the parliament. He came on TV and he said, you know, kind people of Iraq, there are some circumstances that cause people to leave their countries like in all over history. I mean, for lack of shame, I don't understand. Instead of saying, you know, Iraqi people, we are doing our best, we are going to do this, we promise you to do that. And even though we know that their promises mean nothing, still that would have been the thing to say. But instead he comes on and says, we understand that there are some conditions that any country may go through that will make its people leave and immigrate. What do you say to that? I mean, what do you say to that?
Sahar Issa is a journalist living in Baghdad. Thanks for speaking with us.
You are most welcome.